The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts at a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here again with
Tasha Robinson,
Genevieve Kosky,
and Scott Tobias.
On the first half of this episode, we discussed Ed Wood, Tim Burton's salute to the director of what are widely considered to be some of the worst movies ever made, starring Johnny Depp and Martin Landau. In this episode, we'll take a look at The Disaster Artist, James Franco's film about the making of The Room, which has found a cult following among those drawn to what can politely be described as its rough edges and odd choices. James Franco's brother, Dave Franco, plays Greg Sestero, a baby-faced San Francisco actor with dreams of Hollywood stardom who, in the late 1990s, meets Tommy Wiseau, played by James Franco, at an acting class. Tommy is, to say the least, an unusual man. He claims to be from New Orleans, but speaks in an impossible-to-pin-down accent that suggests Eastern Europe. He's coy about his age, drinks Red Bull by the case, and lives in a cluttered apartment. He also seems to be rich, which allows him to propose that he and Greg move to Los Angeles after they become scene partners and unlikely friends. And it's this wealth, also of undetermined origin, that allows him to suggest that when Hollywood seems not to want to make a movie with them, that they just make their own movie. And so they come to make The Room, a kind of overheated, contemporary, Tennessee Williams-inspired drama, written, directed, starring, and financed by Tommy, who plays Johnny, a man torn apart by his girlfriend Lisa's infidelity with Mark, played by Greg. Johnny also has a hard time throwing and catching a football and enjoys saying hi to doggies. Most of the film's second half involves the shooting of the film, a torturous process that goes way over schedule, finds Tommy clashing with his more experienced crew and beleaguered actors as he struggles to complete even the simplest scene. But in the end, he does complete it and screens it, and the response of the audience is not what Tommy anticipates. Was it worth it? That's a question that's kind of left dangling by the end of the movie, which does little to unravel the vagaries of Tommy's history, but ends up revealing a little bit of his soul anyway.
You and me, we both have this dream.
Yeah, I guess we do.
Hey, we'll be famous.
We'll show them.
Watch out, here we come. To be or not to be.
It's not going to happen for you.
Not in a million years.
What after that? This town, Greg. They don't want me.
Wish we could just make our own movie.
That great idea.
So there's this guy, Johnny, a true American hero,
to be played by me.
He has it all. Good luck, many friends. And also, maybe Johnny is a vampire. We'll see.
This set of the alleyway looks exactly like the real alleyway.
That's right.
Well, why don't we just shoot in the real alleyway?
Because it's a real Hollywood movie.
No, yeah, sounds good.
Okay.
Action.
I did not hit her. I did not. Oh, hi, Mark.
What the foot doesn't work if you're looking at the camera?
And then this beautiful girl. Anything for my princess. She betrayed him.
And then this guy, Johnny.
He go crazy. Nobody respect my vision. You are a villain.
I did this whole movie for you, Greg.
You're tearing me apart, Lisa.
cut.
Why you cut, Sandy? This is great. This is real acting.
If you're going to writhe around with the dress, maybe do it before you shoot yourself in the head and blow your brains out.
I disagree.
You're really going to make this thing?
We are going to die.
We got him.
All right, everyone. What did you think of The Disaster Artist? Well, a few of us watched this together, so we kind of know. But I heard you laughing. I saw you laughing.
He's pointing to
well, what about Tasha?
Scott.
Tasha was
Tasha. We don't know what she
Yeah, Tasha, you weren't there.
I was in a remote location. There's a part of me that suspects that this is not that great a film, that the messages are really broad, that the characters are really cartoony, that the whole structure of it is really phony, and the ending in particular is made up and ridiculous and over the top. I really loved this movie, you guys. I laughed so hard. I just really enjoyed it. I kind of enjoyed the cheesiness of it. But for the most part, it's just, I think just watching James Franco wander around in character as Tommy Wiseau for like 90 minutes is value enough for this movie.
Yeah, this movie is, for me, just all about the characters and the performances and the chemistry. Like, I don't want to quite say it's an ensemble film because it's so much about the Francos, but it does kind of have a little bit of that feeling of like the Apatow gang comedy, you know, about it, but there's something more to it that I also really love this film, while sharing your suspicions, Tasha, that maybe I'm just like falling under a spell that is relieving me of all my critical faculties. But I did really like it a lot.
Yeah, I don't think it's a particularly great piece of filmmaking. I don't watch it in thirst for other films directed by James Franco, for example. And I do think the film, I wouldn't say struggles, because I enjoy it the entire way, but I think it doesn't really kick into high gear until the actual filmmaking starts. That to me is when the film becomes something really fun. And then of course, when you get to the part where they're actually showing scenes of the film and even the closing credits, I mean, that stuff is all hilarious. I have kind of a long history with The Room myself. Part of that history is actually reading this book, which I love. Have any of you read this book?
No, I've got it on order.
Yeah, I've downloaded the audiobook because I've heard that the audiobook is so good. Sestero narrates it and apparently does an amazing Wiseau impression.
Oh, wow. So. Oh, I may have to change my order.
That sounds like a good way to encounter it. It punches way above its weight. I think maybe because Tom Bissell, who is a...
maybe. Sorry, what? I'm throwing shade at Sestero's presumed writing abilities.
Yeah, right. I think almost certainly because his writing partner, Sestero's writing partner, is Tom Bissell, who's an actual writer, really great writer. He wrote the short story on which The Loneliest Planet, that movie, The Loneliest Planet, is based.
He also wrote this, the definitive treatment of The Room for Harper's, which is why he was selected for this book.
Okay, yeah. It's just
treatment of The Room after Scott's.
Oh, that's true. I did write an entry on The Room for New Cult Canon right when it was finding its legs as a cult item.
Sestero didn't call you up? What was he thinking?
I don't know.
Almost like he attaches himself to weird, untalented hacks instead of the sterling journalistic people he should be attaching himself to.
Whatever the case, I mean, I'm just going to say that the book belongs on a shelf with Final Cut, the book about Heaven's Gate, and then Bonfire of the Vanities. I mean, I think it's that good. It's really great. And I think this is a fine adaptation of that book, though not done with a tremendous amount of pizzazz. I think the verisimilitude that you really appreciate that makes the film shine has to do with the performances and then, of course, the footage that they actually did shoot, which in the closing credits it's a brag, but it's a wonderful brag.
Yeah.
Because they get every gesture so perfectly right.
You know, I don't actually want to undersell the film's comic timing, which is a big part of it. I mean, for me, the impressions, really, as much as performances, are startling. But it's also just, it's a really funny movie. And part of that does come in the scripting and in the quickness of the comic movements. But Keith, you haven't talked.
Everything you're saying, I'm agreeing with. It's just so much fun to watch. And I'm not sure there's a scene better than the scene that was leaked before it came out, which is the one where they're doing take after take of Tommy walking on the roof, not knowing where to look, not knowing his line. You know, on the one level, it's sort of a pretty obvious gag. On the other hand, it's just so exquisitely done. And Franco's just immersion in this character. Like, I mean, some of it's makeup, but so much of it's just like, he just gets, if you've seen The Room or seen Wiseau interviewed, this is Tommy Wiseau. It's really remarkable. And the only time I really even know it's James Franco, there's a couple of shots of his smile, and he has that sort of unmistakable, like, toothy grin.
His whole face crinkles.
Yeah, yeah. But otherwise, he's just this very odd man from the beginning to end.
Well, there's also the point where he comes out naked and he's not made entirely out of gristle.
True.
I seriously, though, I think of Franco as being like a fairly skinny dude. And I had to go back and watch that scene again. I don't know if he's wearing a full body prosthetic or what, but he somehow ended up with Wiseau's like thick, weirdly muscular body.
I think he did this weird thing called exercise I've heard about.
It's just, I mean, I've heard of transforming yourself for a role, and I've heard of bulking yourself up to play Thor, for instance, but bulking yourself up to play Tommy Wiseau? What kind of career move is that?
I mean, in this very specific case, a very good one. I submit the theory that is, because I agree that I did find the parts where they were actually filming The Room to be the most fun elements of the film, but we are also all very familiar with Tommy Wiseau and what a weirdo he is going into this. I think if you did not have that knowledge and were being introduced to Tommy with this movie, it would be even better. Like, I think that you would really enjoy getting to puzzle over this strange character. For us, I think it's a lot of like, just we're waiting to get to the specific weird thing that we already know about Tommy rather than being surprised by those weird things about him.
I question that because I feel like if I hadn't seen The Room beforehand, I would think that this was exaggerated. I would specifically think that the character of Wiseau, with his strange accent and his strange behavior, like that it all had to be fake. And I've seen a couple of responses online from people who were like, this must be overblown, this must be over the top. And then they get to the sequence at the end where Tommy Wiseau actually shows up and makes a cameo. And they're like, oh my God, that is what he's like. But this is something I would love to hear from listeners on. Probably nobody listening to this podcast is not familiar enough with The Room to recognize that aspect of the Disaster Artist. But if somehow you've made it this far and actually saw the Disaster Artist without seeing The Room or Wiseau first, I would love to hear whether you thought it was too over the top until proved otherwise.
Yeah, you are our unicorn. We want to hear from you.
Yeah, you can't make Wiseau up. Though.
It's hard to type with James,
he's such a weird combination of elements. Like, why that hair? What is that accent?
What about the belts?
What is
all the missing words? Like, whatever's going on with him? He's been in the States for a while. Why does he? Why does he talk that way?
Rule to my class are simple: work hard, show up on time, try not fall asleep, everybody. And question for a start.
It sounds like you're doing. Am I hearing an accent?
No. What do you mean?
Because I'm hearing a kind of Eastern European accent.
No, that's from New Orleans.
Where? What?
New Orleans, you heard, you know.
Where?
The Big Easy.
Oh, New Orleans. I thought, I didn't know what you were saying.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, well, can we just try to lose the accent? Take it again.
The rules to the club are simple. Work hard. On time. Try not to fall asleep. And the question for thought.
I think that about does her.
One thing, though, I will say, though, even if you have seen The Room and have not read The Disaster Artist, is there are specific aspects of this production that are surprising and delightful to discover. One of my favorites being that he purchased all of the equipment, which is unnecessary, and even stranger, decided to shoot the film simultaneously on film and on digital, which of course require totally different lighting schemes. And then, you know, doing all these bizarre green screen scenes when they could have just shot on location. I mean, it's a very subtle thing, but the scene you're talking about that was previewed of him coming out of onto the rooftop and trying to get that line out, that shot is taken from his apartment in San Francisco, right? No, in Los Angeles, right? They could have just shot on location and would have had the Los Angeles backdrop. And then, of course, there's an alley scene that starts the shooting where it's like, why don't we, there's an alley right behind us. Why don't we go shoot out there? And it's like, no.
It's a real Hollywood movie.
Yeah.
I will say, if you've seen The Room, it's even better, though, because the fact that when they go off on that rooftop, you realize it's exactly like the rooftop in the movie, which is very much a fake rooftop. Mm-hmm. The way they keep dwelling on Lisa's mother's cancer diagnosis, like, we don't come back to that? And it's like, if you haven't seen The Room, that's certainly an odd thing to know, but knowing that this is very much a prominent detail of the film makes it all the more amusing.
There are times when that aspect of it feels a little overplayed to me. The whole business of the two of them coming into the equipment rental shop run by Jason Mantzoukas and Hannibal Buress randomly. I mean, in that moment, it feels like they don't know what they're doing and they just kind of randomly throw out, sure, we'll buy the equipment. Yeah, we'll shoot on 35 in video. And nobody ever bothers to correct them. It's presented as something that literally could have happened because they bluffed the wrong thing at the wrong time and nobody ever said anything about it ever again. And I find that really hard to believe. And it's one of many things in this movie that I think plays perfectly well as comedy, but kind of makes me question everything about the movie as far as accuracy goes, because as an actual part of the story, it's hard to make that make sense.
But I think it works because the movie so consistently portrays Tommy as someone who will not listen to anyone and is only concerned with the way that he envisions things going. That suggests that no matter whether anyone said anything, and people do say things, and he does not heed them. So I think it's just, I think it works because of that character.
It's human nature.
One thing that I think the film gets right is what makes The Room, to me, such a magical experience and something, a movie that I've returned to many times, which is two aspects of Wiseau. One is that he is a child. he reacts to the world with the innocence and the petulance and the emotions of someone who's just not mature. That's one aspect of it. And two, and this is part of what makes a lot of bad films, really bad films, interesting, is that it's almost like filmmaking as a second language. Like, he's an alien presence who is just trying to guess at how other human beings behave and not getting it. He just doesn't get it right. You know, the football being the most obvious example, but really just human behavior is something that is an utter mystery to him. And you can see plainly in the film that he just doesn't get it. There's just a fundamental disconnect, and you see that in other kind of so bad it's good movies too, like Troll 2, which was a Italian production made in Utah, or Birdemic is another one, which with I think a Vietnamese director working in America, and it's like, you know, filmmaking is a second language or some massive degree of miscommunication that just is all naked and raw and apparent to us on screen and makes it kind of delightful and strange.
Yeah, there is a degree to which he does feel like he has read, somewhere along the line, he read a paragraph that says, human beings laugh by going ha ha ha. Yeah. Human nature is to react in sometimes in strange ways, strange and unpredictable emotional ways to things.
Well, we never see him in the film have a relationship with anyone really except for Greg. Yeah. And his idea of how humans interact is very off, but there is kind of this, you know, low simmering misogyny in the film. And, you know, it's a funny portrayal, but also in Franco's depiction of Tommy, like, he's not on board with Greg having a girlfriend played by Alison Brie in this movie. It's unclear. It's never really suggested that he has any sort of romantic designs on Greg, but he's definitely wants to be.
I think there's a pretty strong sort of homoeroticism.
It's never overt, you know.
Even when he asks if he wants to sleep in the bedroom with him.
Yeah, I know. It's ambiguous. Let's put it that way. Yeah. But
even when he tries to mimic sex with a woman and doesn't seem to have any idea about the anatomy of it,
he wants to have Greg to himself. And women in general do not seem to be particularly appealing to him.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's a degree to which people aren't that appealing to him, except sort of as reflections for his own ego. Like, he doesn't necessarily understand. There's a current of loneliness to him that, to a small degree, mirrors kind of the current of loneliness that you see in Martin Landau's Bela Lugosi in Ed Wood. There's that sense of needing someone. But at the same time, it's not clear what he needs other people for, except once again to satisfy this vision that he has of friendship. Like, he's read a book about friendship.
He has to have a friend because it's an American thing to do. I don't think the disaster artist engages it that much, but like one of the things, and this kind of goes back to what you were saying, Scott, about the sort of alien quality, is just like Tommy's naked desire to be seen as American, whatever he thinks American is, you know, or like the all-American boy. And, you know, like we do see that a little bit in the roles he is going out for and, you know, presenting himself as the all-American leading man and the guy who can play football. And can we just talk about the football real quick, because obviously that is a very famous part of the room and we get to see it realized as it's in the film, but we also get an earlier scene that scene in the room is supposedly based on, of Greg and Tommy throwing a football around in San Francisco. And like, I think it's such a treat for fans of the room who are familiar with this scene that is in that movie to kind of see it like amplified in this earlier version where Tommy like has even less idea of how to do this thing that he like is convinced that he knows how to do because it's all American and he's an all American.
And hero is the thing he wants to be. Yes, he doesn't want to be, right. Everyone wants to cast him as a villain because of his presence and his accent and his kind of mysterious and hostile.
His Lugosi-esque.
Well, that's
for connections.
But I think there's like a thing where, yeah, I mean, it's a treat to see them go onto the roof in Los Angeles, and you recognize that location, or to see them go to the park and throw the ball around, because that also appears in the film. And it kind of feeds into the idea that The Room is just an extremely personal film, that he's putting his life on screen in a fairly direct way. And that's part of what makes the film resonant and special. And I think you get that, too, in that. The speculation that they have on set that, you know, somebody really must have broken Tommy's heart, I think that's probably true as well, though we don't know from the disaster artist book or film specifically who that person is or what exactly happened. But the film confronts that in a way that we can only understand as being personal.
We should talk about the last scene, the premiere of the film, which kind of goes through, I think, kind of the history of the room's reception, kind of squeezes mm-hmm. all into one mm-hmm. one scene where the audience isn't sure what to make of it, and then it kind of turns into a laugh riot for those in attendance, and then Tommy has to kind of sort through his feelings and attempt to cover it up by saying it was sort of a black comedy that he intended all along, which is what he will say when asked about The Room. How'd that play for everybody? I mean, it's funny. I almost felt like it was a little too neat, but what did everyone else think?
I thought it was too neat. I thought it was too neat and corny and just really extreme. It also reminded me so much of The Producers and the process that the audience goes through with Springtime for Hitler. But to me, it was just too much. It was like, I understand how you need to put a button on all of this, and you don't have time to stretch out the process of how this movie became a cult hit. But as you say, I think they just pack way too much into that sequence, and then they stretch it out way, way, way too long. The process of people coming to laughter over it, like The Producer shows you exactly how to do that with perfect comic timing. For me, the process and The Disaster Artist just took too long.
Yeah, agree. And I think it feels even more on the nose when combined with the opening scene, which has a bunch of celebrities talking about The Room and the reception, and basically like kind of already filled in that knowledge. So the final scene is just sort of like playing it out within the narrative, which, as I understand it, is not from the Disaster Artist book, like that the book cuts off before the premiere. So that is like the one part of this movie that is most fully imagined independent of the source material.
And it's the part that doesn't work.
And it's the part that doesn't work.
And it's the part that isn't true. I mean,
there's no way it happened the way it happened.
I mean, I read an interview with one of the actresses from the film, and she openly says it was nothing like that. She said that half the audience walked out within the first 5 minutes, and that there were definitely people laughing, but not necessarily in a friendly or an enjoying it kind of way, and that it wasn't a packed house, and obviously didn't give that speech. Like, a lot of those details are just made up for the film, and made up for that film in a way that feels pretty artificial.
That's something that movies do, is to compress things. I mean, this feels like, you know, taking months worth of development of an audience and how the cult sort of developed certain habits and lines, and it became like this Rocky Horror situation. And like the one example that felt really false to me is at the end of the movie when he is riling around and he gets the gun and everyone starts shouting, "Do it! Do it." I mean, that's something that happens when you see it as a midnight movie, but it seems to me that that would have taken a long time to develop as a conceit.
I think they would naturally not want to be insulting to Tommy.
Yeah, either. Knowing yeah. that he's there, yeah, and that the whole premiere. Cast is there.
Right, it's a friendlier audience, or ostensibly friendlier audience, than total strangers who are just there to kind of laugh at the movie. And these are people who have some personal investment in what's happening. I think it's certainly fair to say that they would be laughing at the movie. It is impossible to watch and not find. I mean, I remember, like, I saw it first on DVD. I didn't see it in the theater. And I think I remember
did we watch it for the first time together?
I think I watched it by myself.
Maybe the second time you watched it.
But I think I brought you all in just to see the double graphics in the opening, like the two cheesy computer graphics that I have
two production logos.
For
which
film.
The disaster artist like makes note of.
It does, yep.
Which I like.
Good for it. And I think that's immediately something that you can find funny about the movie. I mean, it is immediately a funny experience. The very first time I watched The Room by myself on DVD, I yucked it up like crazy. I think it played great. I mean,
I don't think I would have made it through it if I'd watched it that way. My first experience with The Room was at a midnight showing at the Music Box Theater here in Chicago with a packed crowd who threw spoons. Mm-hmm. And like, we knew what to expect, but like, I don't know, the point where a bunch of people like ran up front and they're talking to Tommy and he looks like he's looking down at them and talking to them. And they've got their perfect comic timing down to how to interact with the screen. It's like watching people who've done Rocky Horror for years. Mm-hmm. The script is so established at this point. I mean, it was a pretty perfect way of encountering the film for the first time. It felt like, you know, when somebody who really loves a movie sits you down and says, you have to watch this, yeah, and lets you watch it and then talks to you about it afterwards. It was like that, except it was happening in real time with a bunch of fans who knew the film. And it felt like a really friendly experience.
Yeah, and I was a little over The Room. I felt like sort of the fandom kind of got a little overwhelmingly mm-hmm. huge a few years ago. And this kind of brought back a lot of warm feelings. But I think I would probably never go see The Room again now, just because I think this is going to bring in a lot of new fans that perhaps won't respect the traditions of the Room elders like Scott Tobias.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think those people will be dominant voices just as they are in Rocky Horror. I think one thing you could say is in The Room experience, there is a very uncomfortable and vocal level of misogyny that it is part of the audience participation that I don't like at all. Mm-hmm. And it makes me super uncomfortable to be around even in that first screening. Though I will say, God, my very favorite audience participation thing in The Room is there are a couple of weird shots of the Golden Gate Bridge.
Go,
everyone says go, 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 and it doesn't make it. The camera doesn't make it across the bridge the first time, and so people are always are all upset. And then when it finally makes it, it's just such an extraordinary triumph, and there's all these cheers in the audience. It's just like that kind of audience participation I really like. But all of the hostility directed toward the Juliet Danielle character,
yeah,
I can do without.
Vince Mancini, who writes for Uproxx, tracked down Juliet Danielle for an email interview, and she's a great sport about the whole thing, but she says that element is a bummer. And it's like what I was saying, that the old fans are awesome, new people discover the movie and like feel the need to comment on her body on social media, and it's just kind of a constant bummer for her.
Yeah,
that is gross and unenjoyable. I find it interesting.
What? That's a really good segue. Good segue, Tasha.
I find it interesting that the disaster artist itself glosses over some aspects of that. Like, we get to see Tommy being super unpleasant to the actress during the sex scene, but we kind of remove the whole part of the narrative where he originally had a different actress in the role and he didn't like how the sex scene worked out and he called somebody else in to do it. And there's like a whole aspect to that that's kind of played out in some circles. Like, some circles think of the whole shooting process as him just trying to get with a series of women, him basically using a casting bed as a casting couch. There's a lot of unpleasantness to that. And instead, what we get in the disaster artist is the actress urging him on, trying to talk everybody else down from defending her, saying that she's all right, that everything is going fine. And it became a really weird mechanic, especially in the environment we're in right now, mm-hmm. watching somebody be so unprofessional and unpleasant to a woman and having her tell an entire room of people and seemingly meaning it. it's okay. You don't need to defend me. You don't need to be upset on my behalf. Given the huge gap between the actual history with the film there and what we see on screen, I just found that a weird series of choices, especially in a comedy.
I mean, I think it is what it is. I was happy that that scene was there and that we got to see Tommy at his worst and that we got to see that reaction from her too, because I mean, there is something I think productively discomforting about the reaction that she has of it's okay, I'm fine, etc. Maybe she's not fine, but maybe that's her way of getting through a moment like that.
She's trying to be a pro.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, and she wants it. She probably wants it over with, and she doesn't want a lot of attention paid. It is in its own way realistic to how women are trained to respond in uncomfortable circumstances. It just plays in a very strange way, I think.
Did you not see it similar to the Meyerowitz stories a bit in the way it's responded with the guys who are angry and wanting to kick his ass or whatever, and mm-hmm. and her having a contrasting reaction to that?
No, not at all, because in that sequence, she's able to come along safely after it's all over and give her commentary on it, and she's not physically involved. It's not like she gets physically abused in that scene or she's implicated in it in some way. She sees what they've done and tells them what she thinks of it. But we're not actually seeing her discomfited in it.
Well, we want to keep talking about the disaster artist, but we should probably go back and bring in Ed Wood as part of that process. So we'll be right back after the break with Connections.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Finished. It's my masterpiece.
Greatest drama since the Tennessee Williams.
The Room.
The Room. Nobody read it yet. So today, you'll be first one.
Yeah, all right.
It's all right.
Oh, you want me to read it right now?
Yeah, what's this thing?
Okay. The Room.
I'll do anything for my girl. You should marry Johnny. Did you know that chocolate is the symbol of love? We can't do this anymore. I keep thinking about your strong hands around my body. Anyway, how's your sex life? I don't think she's faithful to me.
Life gets complicated. The unexpected happens.
In a few minutes, bitch.
If a lot of people loved each other, the world will be a better place to live.
Done. Oh.
Well, what you think?
I mean, it's great. I can't believe it, man. You did this. You.
And of course, you play Mark.
But you want me to play Mark in this?
Hey, big role. Secondly.
Well, yeah, it's a huge role. Are you sure?
Oh, you don't want to do it? Fine. Maybe Johnny Depp available.
No. I want it. I want the role. I'll take it.
It's like you say. Hollywood reject us, then we do it on our own.
Wait, you have the money to make this?
I have. It's no problem.
You're really going to make this thing?
No, Greg. We are going to do it.
Now it's time for Connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. We can start with the obvious, bad movies, why we watch them and how they're made.
I think one of the most interesting things to me in contrast in these two movies is that, again, as I say, I feel like that Tor Johnson scene where Ed Wood watches him crash into the set and the set wobble and is like, cut, print, it's perfect. It's okay that he crashes into the set because that is something that this man would have to deal with every day because of his size. It parallels so neatly with Tommy Wiseau's reacting to Mark's, I knew a woman who got beaten so badly she ended up in the hospital. What a story. And how he's told by his script supervisor over and over, that's not a good reaction. And he's like, it's human nature. Both of them have this weird idea of how they think they're reflecting humanity in their film. But I think in both cases, what we're seeing is just this crucial lack of attention to detail and to how the cinematic language works. And maybe it was having just seen The Disaster Artist made me read that scene that way, Genevieve, mm-hmm. instead of the way you saw it.
Yeah.
But I think in both cases, we just get this sort of idea of this is why these two guys make really bad films, is because their instincts are just 180 degrees wrong.
One question I wanted to ask the group, because this is something that comes up often in discussions of The Room and other So Bad It's Good entertainment, is, do you feel bad about it? Do you feel bad about participating in it and bad about laughing at someone's creation? Is there a mean-spiritedness to it that gives you a little bit of pause?
So I have a long history of watching bad movies. It's something that I used to do a lot with my friends in high school, especially. We sought out bad movies. And so, you know, I'm guilty as charged in terms of making fun of them. I also found my tolerance for just wasting my time watching bad movies has dimmed over the years as well. But I think the ones that really stand out are the ones that have, like we've talked about, have a character all their own. And you feel like you are at least sharing the spirit of these eccentric outsider artists as much as you're making fun of them. You know, they're coming about this art form through very, you know, different angles, but they have a unique take on things, and you can kind of appreciate that, even if it's not technically accomplished. I don't want to, like, bend over backwards, because some of it is just watching the incompetence on screen. But, you know, if there wasn't something to celebrate there, if there wasn't some kind of, like, spirit or flair all its own, it would be something different. It's not like you're making fun of a bad student film. That is just, you know, it's kicking a puppy.
I like doing that, too. No, there was a particular thesis film I encountered when I was at the University of Miami that we would watch over again, because it used the Batman score and the James Bond score as a temp track that was never changed. Oh, my God.
Well,
so great. But I know you're
a bad person.
I'm a bad person.
Yeah,
I remember I
judged a student short film contest, and it's like, did everybody break up with their girlfriend before they made these?
Well, you know, making a film is a time-consuming endeavor that leaves one with not a lot of time for one's girlfriend. So
what about you all? A bad movie remorse? Do you feel it?
Not a whole lot, because I think, like, a fundamental aspect of art is, like, once you release it into the world, it is no longer fully yours. It belongs in some part to the people who consume it. You know, not all artists would agree with that, but as a consumer of art, that is my feeling. I do think there is an element in terms of these two movies specifically where you have to take the creator into account. And I don't feel bad laughing at The Room at all because of Wiseau and how he has conducted himself regarding this movie and the mm-hmm. extent to which he has just kind of capitalized on the reaction to it and made it work for him.
Yeah.
So fine, you know, like that. I don't feel bad about The Room. I'm not well versed at all in Ed Wood's films, so I, you know, I can't really speak to that, but I might feel a little differently about it knowing how his story ended.
Yeah, for me, it just comes down to, like, how much do I know about the story behind the film and what they were trying to do and the people involved? Because knowing almost any of the story about how a piece of art was created, like, activates my empathy gland. once you know that somebody was trying to do something that they didn't achieve, it becomes very hard for me to get around that. The thing for me is, I've never been that much of a fan of bad movies and the bad movie watching experience. It can be fun with a good group of people and enough booze, but it was never something that I sought out when I was younger. And, like, I've had some really, really good experiences with terrible movies.
We watched The Apple at your house, didn't we?
We did.
You did have a bad movie night, Tasha.
What about MST3K?
I think also that some of my enthusiasm for bad movies has filtered through Mystery Science Theater 3000, mm-hmm. which is far more entertaining than watching any other movies they watch on their own. That's a brilliant show.
Mm-hmm.
For me, The Apple aside, because we did have people over to watch The Apple, and that is a tremendous, tremendous bad movie. But for the most part, I find that the best experiences are the unplanned ones. One of my best movie going experiences ever was watching the Clash of the Titans remake in the theater with a bunch of friends, so drunk I could barely sit up. And we weren't planning for it. I was not planning to get
this
that drunk.
Turn into Tasha's confession hour.
It's not a confession if you don't feel guilty about it. I wasn't planning for the movie to be that bad. I wasn't planning to get that drunk. It just happened. And that's where the spontaneity came
in. It's not good, but I think the drunkenness might have exaggerated just how bad it is.
That's a whole nother conversation. My point is, I know nothing about the people who made that movie. I know nothing about what they were trying to achieve. I know nothing about how they feel about that movie flopping to the degree that it did. So I don't have to feel guilty. I would feel guilty seriously enjoying the badness of an Ed Wood movie.
I mean, and the thing about Wizzo, though, is like, I think he was sort of forced to steer into the curve. It had to have been painful for him. And the film reckons with this a little bit, to experience a bunch of people laughing at what for him was a very serious and personal film. It had to. And I think he just found his way out by saying, hey, hope you enjoyed my comedy that I totally intended for you all to laugh and enjoy. And I just think that probably wasn't his initial reaction. I think he probably had to adjust. And I think he's done a perfectly fine job of embracing that culture and having a good time with it and making his money back, which is a lot, which, you know, he dug quite a hole for himself financially to make it.
I mean,
and
we don't know how much money he has. It could have just been a drop in the bucket.
That account, bottomless pit.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think that's why I found that final scene so artificial, is I would have liked to have seen some of the process of him coming to that realization. Because as you say, I think there was more to it than that. And it ends up making him feel very facile.
So there's so much compression happening at that
moment.
It also
makes him seem more savvy than he is. So to like come to that conclusion immediately, you know, that's a self-awareness and savvy that we have not seen Wizzo display up to that point.
No.
I think it's interesting that the corresponding scene in Ed Wood, we don't get to see him getting any of that reaction. Like he sits down to it and he says, this is the one I'm going to be remembered for. But we don't get to see him watching them laugh at his movie and him like trying to figure out what to do with that.
No,
like,
it's a triumph.
He goes out on a triumphant note. I have this whole theory about movies that end at the last good moment. Welcome to the Dollhouse, that kind of thing, where you go out on a high moment, if only because you cut in the middle of a scene and the possibly the next second is miserable. And that's what that feels like here.
I mean, Ed Wood's life after that was very unhappy and full of tragedy and mishaps. And that was a high note. What's not in these films is just a whole nother sadder, weirder story the filmmakers have chosen for sound reasons not to include.
I think there's sort of a parallel here then, Scott, and I'm curious what you have to say about this, between watching a bad movie and laughing at it and wondering whether we should feel empathy with the filmmakers and feel guilty for enjoying the movie as a bad experience, and watching something like Ed Wood, which turns a complicated, tragic filmmaker story into something like relatively neat and pat to illustrate a series of points that a filmmaker has. Should we feel bad about a biopic, basically, that is shaped like a comedy and is about expressing the things that Tim Burton always expresses? Is that disrespectful to the subject?
In terms of just not missing who he was and what his essence is or something like that?
If it's disrespectful to watch a bad movie and laugh at it, it seems like it would be disrespectful to watch Ed Wood and be entertained by this tragic life that's being recast for us as a not tragic life.
I think it's just a choice Tim Burton and company made of just framing the film as they did. And I'm perfectly happy with that choice of, you know, ending on this triumphant note as they do. You know, what was really heartwarming and satisfying about the ending of Ed Wood is the troupe of just all of them coming together, sitting down as a group with their families, being really excited and having the, you know, the film that Ed Wood feels he'll be remembered by, you know, unspool in front of the audience, like a proper premiere. And you really get a sense of triumph and esprit de corps and closeness, you know, and warmth that is maybe common to a lot of filmmakers when they have reached that point in the filmmaking process where they've just, it's all so painful and difficult to put a production together and to make a movie, and there's so many ups and downs, but at the end of it you get this premiere where they're all this little family that has come together to have this experience, and then of course it breaks up after that.
Yeah, it's kind of another connection between the two films, and it's in The Disaster Artist that family kind of forms without Tommy. It's kind of like these people bonding on the shared experience of like this sort of difficult process of making this film. And I think if this, the last scene played a little differently, you can kind of see it as sort of a tremendous relief that they, you know, they've bonded together to make this movie, and they're kind of rejecting it en masse in spite of Tommy. But I think it's a meaner film if you do it that way.
I mean, because of Tommy. I mean, none of them like him,
right?
Except for Sestero, and Sestero, even Sestero has to be cajoled. He has no plans to go to the premiere, and has to be, you know, personally cajoled by Wizzo to come back into the fold. And so I think there's definitely a interesting contrast between how the troupe that makes the room reacts to their director, and then how the troupe in that made Plan 9 reacts to Ed Wood with so much more affection.
Just, each time, just getting the gang back together to make another movie with Ed Wood.
Yeah,
I would like to use this opportunity to maybe talk about those troops a little bit.
Sure.
And, you know, these are both movies with big casts and, you know, with a lot of kind of memorable characters and performances. So,
man, seeing Jeffrey Jones again after what happened to Jeffrey Jones was a weird experience.
Oh, I didn't even think of that. I completely forgot. Yeah.
I mean, Ed Wood opens on him talking directly to the camera. And I had a moment of, I don't want you to talk to me, Jeffrey Jones.
Yeah.
That was sort of a weird recall moment because it's been a while since we've seen him because of the scandal that overtook his life. But there was a point in the 80s and 90s where he was like relatively ubiquitous.
Yeah.
So seeing him again like brought up a lot of weird memories. But there's a lot of famous faces in the troupe in Disaster Artist to a point where we were introduced to his crew. I was sitting there like bursting into laughter at every new person we were introduced to.
I love Seth Rogen and the Disaster Artist.
He's so great.
That character, Sandy Schlaer, who is a Hollywood veteran who was script supervisor on The Room and by all accounts is the only reason it made it to a final film. I mean, it's very much the Greek Chorus commenting on this is so insane, but it's a really tricky balancing act he manages of like scorn and affection that comes through the kind of throughout the movie, but especially in that final scene.
He's someone who actually knows how movies are made and realizes how far off this is from that.
Yeah. And but is like kind of in it for the ride.
Sure.
Which he was not in real life. That was one of the things I ran across just like researching the Real Room story. He walked off the set to go work on another film.
Yeah.
He did an interview with EW where he said, I could spend my day shooting Tommy's naked ass or go work with a DP with two Oscars. So yeah, he quit and went to work on another film. But I find it fascinating that you enjoy Seth Rogen so much because
you just hate him so much, Tasha.
Here's the thing. I have a knee-jerk response to actors. Once actors get to a certain point and I feel like they're being lazy and phoning it in, Seth Rogen in this movie is Seth Rogen in his last 27 movies. Is Seth Rogen in real life?
But I think it works for this character.
Yeah, for sure. I actually think it usually works. I like Seth Rogen. But I think there's an interesting thing going on this where it's not even an overtly comedic character, but he's a funny person. It's kind of like in the Steven Soderbergh film, The Informant, which is not an overtly comic film in a lot of ways, but it's filled with comic actors. There's kind of the same thing here where it's just sort of like naturally funny people put in this absurd situation and not really overplaying the comedy, but there's some sort of just sort of comic resonance just by having them around.
You kind of get that with Bill Murray's character
and
Ed Wood too. Like, I mean, it's actually kind of a sad character.
I think it's kind of like the vision of Bill Murray performances to come. It's the first time we really saw those shades of Bill Murray.
Yeah.
It was good to see Josh Hutcherson in this movie too as Denny. Good little Honeycrisp.
Honeycrisp.
And the Zac Efron reveal moment at the end of The Disaster Artist I thought was a real hoot.
Did you, some of the people in our little screening did not recognize him as Chris R.
I did not know.
You did not recognize that as Zac Efron. That was really funny.
Zac Efron, chameleon.
One critical connection, I think, between Ed Wood and The Disaster Artist is the idea of the two filmmakers as outsiders, of people who have been rejected by the system and by Hollywood, and then having to find other means through which to make their own movies. For Tommy, it becomes completely DIY because he has all this money, and for Ed Wood, he has to, you know, con this Baptist church into funding his movie, which will of course be in this popular genre that's going to earn them enough money to make the religious films that they want to make. And I love all that stuff when they're getting baptized and going through all that rigmarole. But that's a pretty critical element of both films is casting those two as outsiders in the Hollywood system, as going beyond the gatekeepers, and both films finding actual inspiration in that too, like authentic inspiration in filmmakers who have the courage and the audacity to not go through the system and to do things on their own.
It's interesting that we see two filmmakers with processes that are so different yet equally inept, you know, in their own ways. And like, I think the biggest contrast that is also very telling between these two films is the extent to which we see the financing happening in Ed Wood Whereas in The Disaster Artist and The Room, it's just Tommy has is an endless font of money, you know? And each of those circumstances lends to a terrible movie in its own way. In Ed Wood's case, because he has to like make these stupid compromises that he does because that's the kind of filmmaker he is. And he doesn't really apparently care that much that, you know, his leading man has to be someone who's never acted before. And Tommy can just indulge in his ineptitude because he doesn't have anyone answer to. So like it results in the same caliber of product, but from two very different circumstances.
For me, what's interesting about the filmmaking process in these two movies is that because there is a certain like inescapable like regimentation to how films work, and because just of the personalities involved, we get all of these little like rhyming sequences between the two films that are completely unintended, that are just natural parallels. In both movies, we get the sequence of the screenwriter dropping his script on somebody mm-hmm. and saying, "You've got to read this yep. right now. I'm going to sit here and watch you." In both cases, we get the rallying cry for the troops that is, we're about to make this movie, here's the big speech that's going to get you all revved up. And in both cases, it's a comic slow ride up the roller coaster because we know what the ride down the roller coaster is going to be like. Mm-hmm. In both cases, we have a scene where a temperamental actor has a complete ego meltdown and has to be like slowly coaxed back and told over and over that they're fantastic and wonderful and that everybody loves them, and just kind of like petted back down from that like bristly cat kind of feel. In both cases, we have something going wrong on set and the director not noticing and saying that it's okay. And then in both cases, of course, we have the big triumphant screening at the end. There's just this feeling that I got like midway through Ed Wood. It's like, I just watched this film. Yeah. There's so many beats that are the same beat.
I think what you're saying, Tasha, is that we pair these movies very well. It's really kind of a pairing of four movies, two bad ones, two good ones, all worth talking about. Disaster Artist is currently in theaters. Ed Wood films have kind of gotten a little hard to track down in their original format. There's some DVDs out there. There's some colorized versions, which I hate colorization, you know, and you're going to lose like what these films actually look like if you do that. But, you know, I don't know, turn on the color on your TV or something. and The Room is widely available on DVD and I think some streaming services.
Is it?
No,
widely
it's nowhere
available?
On streaming.
No,
interesting. As of fairly recently, was still distributing it himself. Mm-hmm. You can definitely get a copy of a DVD, especially like used and stuff on Amazon. Mm-hmm.
But, and may as well buy it. You're going to want to watch it more than once.
But also there are screenings everywhere right now, especially.
Yeah. If you're in a big city, though.
Yeah, if you're in a big city, yeah. You should definitely make it.
I mean, if you're in a big city, there's a really good chance that Sestero's touring behind it right now. Tommy Wiseau shows up for the Music Box ones regular basis. Like, who knows who you're going to see at The Room?
We'll be right back with our usual recommendation segment, Your Next Picture Show.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show in the hopes it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Tasha, what in the film world has been good for you lately?
I'm just going to call out a few things that I read on my ramp up to this podcast, sort of a bunch of short hits. I read a lot of stuff about The Room. I wish I could have read the book, but I didn't have time. There's an article in EW from 2011 that gets into Sandy Sklar and his experiences on The Room. Among other things, they have this snippet of dialogue that Sklar reported between him and Wiseau. "Do you want me to direct your project?" "No, I am director." "Yeah, you're the director, whatever. You want me to direct your movie for you?" "Yes, please." That's what he says the exchange was between him and Wiseau. So it gets into a bunch of Sklar's impressions about how the film went. There's a lot of interesting info in there. There's a slight article called What's Fact and What's Fiction in The Disaster Artist that is where I got the business about Sklar not wanting to spend his day shooting Tommy's naked ass. And that's actually a really detailed article with a lot of interesting stuff. Marissa Martinelli wrote that. And it's just kind of a breakdown of where the film played fast and loose with reality and where it's remarkably accurate. As anybody who stays through the credits, the closing credits of The Disaster Artist knows, like, they did pay an immense amount of attention to the detail and the rhythms and the pacings of the film and how to reproduce it as well as possible. But of course, they made a lot of changes for timing and comedy and just functionality. And this article gets into it in some really interesting and detailed ways. Finally, Funny or Die is doing a series right now, directed by one of the Room's actors, and it's called The Room Actors. Where Are They Now? It's six of the actors from The Room kind of doing like the Where Are They Now thing, I guess. But it's immensely tongue-in-cheek and over the top, and it features them kind of examining some of the biggest in-jokes about The Room, not in any way in a serious way. Like, the writer-director, Robin Paris, who played Michelle in The Room, there's a whole sequence where they're talking to her about how she doesn't actually like scotchka all that much. Her preferred drink of choice is Berbequila. So it's pretty broad humor along that line. There's a whole sequence with Catherine Minot, who plays Carolyn, talking about how she doesn't have breast cancer, but she definitely has fill in the blank. I definitely have shingles. I definitely have hemorrhoids, and on and on and on. So it really digs into a bunch of running jokes about The Room. It's very much for Room fans. But it's also just sort of interesting to see, like, these six people who were united by this bizarre experience doing a different thing together, making fun of that bizarre experience. And as broad and silly as it does get, it makes you feel kind of, again, like you're in the club, like you're watching these people hang out together and have a good time doing something new. That series is in progress. They've only posted the first one. There's going to be a series of them. But it's called The Room Actors, Where Are They Now? And it's available for free on Funny or Die. Genevieve, what's good for you?
Well, mine is not directly related to any of the films we're talking about, but it does share kind of, I think, the same fun, go-for-broke spirit as The Disaster Artist, which is a new film called I, Tanya, from director Craig Gillespie, starring Margot Robbie as embattled Olympic figure skater Tanya Harding. This is a narrative film that takes the form of a documentary, or at least nods at that form, through recreations by actors of what the film calls wildly contradictory, totally true interviews with Harding and others, including Sebastian Stan as her ex-boyfriend with a name made for late-night comedy monologues, Jeff Galooly, and Allison Janney in an incredible performance as Harding's domineering-slash-abusive mother. The story is designed as a reevaluation of a scandal, in this case the assault on Nancy Kerrigan by an associate of Galooly's at the 1994 Nationals, and the subsequent national fascination with Kerrigan and Harding's quote-unquote feud at the Winter Olympics. And it does eventually land at a place that more or less absolves Harding of wrongdoing in that scandal without letting her entirely off the hook for her behavior. But this, to me, is most successful as a character study of this extraordinary athlete who was self-proclaimed white trash, trying to excel in an image-centric sport that clearly wanted nothing to do with her. I, Tanya is all about the chip on Harding's shoulder and how it helps shape the narrative around her. But there are a lot of other super compelling threads to the story that screenwriter Stephen Rogers does a really good job weaving together. It's also just really fun filmmaking with an interesting structure that's full of fourth wall breaking, smart use of special effects in the skating sequences, and a soundtrack that borders on oppressive but absolutely fits the film's go for broke aesthetic. Critics love this film. I love this film. I think it's a really good time in the movies that you can and should head to the theater for. It's out now. I, Tanya.
I dug that one too. I mean, there are a few things that stand out about it for me. One is that it's kind of conceived the Tanya Harding story as sort of a Coen Brothers dimwit caper,
yep,
kind of.
For sure.
So it's got that aspect to it. I think that the skating sequences are weirdly overachieving.
Yeah.
They're amazingly well done, like way beyond what the film actually needed to do. Yeah. And then the other thing I liked about it as well is I feel like it's a good take on her. You know, not only just this incident with Nancy Kerrigan and all the things leading up to it, but also on the sport itself and what the sport values, mm-hmm. which isn't really athleticism.
Yeah.
And that was something that she brought to the sport. You know, her ability to pull off the, was it triple axel?
First woman to land it in competition.
Yeah, I mean, and that's real athleticism. And however that was packaged was something that was controversial and made her sort of ostracized from that world, but probably shouldn't have. And I was happy to see the film make the case for that.
Keith, what about you?
Yeah, this is a really easy one. I've been watching a lot of movies lately, but they're all kind of end of the year award season stuff that we'll either be talking about or you'll be hearing about ad nauseum. I, Tanya was actually going to be one possible choice for me. I like that movie a lot too. But I'm going to recommend something very relevant to your interest if you enjoyed this podcast, which is just in general, the You Must Remember This podcast by Karina Longworth, which is terrific. And it's each a bunch of episodes dedicated to Hollywood history. I imagine the overlap between our listenership and their listenership is pretty heavy. If you like movies, that's a great podcast. But specifically, they just did a series called Bela and Boris, which is a history of Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff and their careers and the ways their rivalry and the way their careers overlapped. The whole thing is great. Patton Oswalt does the voice of Boris Karloff. Taron Killam does the voice of Bela Lugosi. And there's a lot of great Hollywood history there. And there's one episode that is basically about the relationship between Bela Lugosi and Ed Wood. And it's quite good. It confirms a lot of the details that you see in the film Ed Wood and gives you more details and some sadder details possibly than you want to know about that relationship. But yeah, highly recommend it. Cue that up after this if you haven't listened to it already. Scott, how about you?
I wanted to recommend a lovely little documentary called Quest. Quest is a documentary about an African-American family in a neighborhood in North Philadelphia. They're the Rainey family, Christopher Rainey, Christina Rainey, and their 13-year-old daughter, PJ. And what's interesting about it, this is a four-year project by Jonathan Olszewski. And he committed to this project, and about 20 minutes into the documentary, PJ gets shot by a stray bullet. It hits her. She loses sight in her left eye and has to wear a prosthetic for the rest of her life. And the thing, what's so remarkable about the incident is that the documentary would have existed without it. The commitment to make the film was already in place, and this was just something that happened in the flow of their lives, which is just so shocking, and it's such a statement about the prevalence of in the danger of violence in the neighborhood in which they live. So there's that aspect, but there's also just this incredible attention to domestic detail. The film's goal is just to show how this family operates, who these people are, what their relationship is. I mean, the one small hook that it has is that Christopher Rainey runs this studio out of his basement in which he features a lot of young hip-hop artists, and he has Freestyle Fridays and this sort of thing. And so that's a kind of a subplot that plays out, but it's really just about a family, you know, just an ordinary working class black family. And it's just a beautifully articulated vision of what their lives are like over the course of this 4 years. And the 4 years, quite pointedly, is bookended by the re-election of Barack Obama and the election of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And how that does and does not figure into the lives of the Rainey. So a lovely little movie that's rolling out in a very small way in big cities now, but will surely resurface on streaming services when it finally gets to video, but worth checking out. It's called Quest.
And that's it for this week's edition of the Next Picture Show. Our next episodes come out December 26th and 28th. Scott, what are we discussing?
Summer in Italy. Riding bikes over cobblestone, day trips to the Mediterranean, wine, apricots, gelato, and, in the case of Call Me By Your Name and The Talent of Mr. Ripley, bronzed bodies and forbidden passions. With Call Me By Your Name appearing near or at the top of many top 10 lists, we wanted to take a closer look at Luca Guadagnino's sun-dappled coming-of-age story about a 17-year-old who takes a romantic interest in the handsome American doctoral student that comes to stay with his family for the summer. We picked up on many similarities to Anthony Minghella's The Talent of Mr. Ripley, which turns a Patricia Highsmith novel about an American imposter in Italy into a tragic thriller about suppressed gay desire. With the weather turning cold, I think it's a good time for a European vacation.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of Ed Wood, The Disaster Artist, and anything else film-related. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may post your response on Facebook for discussion or read it on a future episode of the show. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Scott?
You can find me on Twitter @Scott_Tobias, and you can find my work at the New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, Vulture, Variety. I'm also the editor-in-chief of Oscilloscope Laboratories' Musings blog. Genevieve?
You can find me at the culture section at Vox.com and on Twitter at Genevieve Kosky. Tasha?
You can find me as the film and TV editor, both editing and writing about film and TV at TheVerge.com. You can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. You can find me writing about books at NPR Books occasionally, including on the 2017 Book Concierge, the huge project where we try to sum up all of the year's best books. Keith?
You can find me at uprocks.com, where I'm the editorial director of film and television. You can find me on Twitter at kfip3000. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net, via Twitter at nextpicturepod, and via Facebook at facebook.com/nextpictureshow. And if you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it. Apple Podcast subscriptions are an important part of getting podcasts more prominence and more listeners. And while you're there, we appreciate every rating and review. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keeps the show going. Thanks to Dan the Man Jakes for his assistance producing the podcast, and thanks to Delmark Records for providing recording space at their home base, Riverside Studios. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts and the Panoply Network. Pull the strings. You are my rose, you are my